And good morning. Welcome to a beautiful Saturday morning. I really didn't think that the clouds would be parted, but when I go outside, you can see like a velvety pink glow and purple on the horizon. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. That's a gift from God. How encouraging. I know we're going through difficult times. I want to start off this program this morning by reading a quote from Frank Ryan, MD, who has written a little bit about viruses. I've kind of decided that I want to devote myself to studying these things until I have a complete or a more sufficient understanding. Did I just say the word complete? No, I don't think anybody can ever know everything that can be known about this, but it says in the Bible that my people are destroyed from a lack of knowledge. You have to decide if you're going to learn and increase your knowledge and grow. Maybe you can start off by asking for some wisdom. It's a pretty good plan, isn't it? Frank Ryan, MD, said, "It serves little purpose merely to be scared by viruses, but it serves a good deal of purpose to understand them." And I thought to myself, he's right. I'm looking at a book right here. It's called Herbal Antivirals by Stephen Herod Buhner. He has a very interesting writing style. But he also has a style of a person that's really poured themselves into this topic. And you can tell that he's trying to understand. So if I can, I want to read a few excerpts from his book. And I want to give him the credit for it. But very, very grateful to have someone that's trying to understand how can we make this work. He goes on to write that plant-based medicines, unlike pharmaceutical drugs, they do not cause any resistance problems. They're much safer, and they are ecologically sound. They are biodegradable and renewable, which most pharmaceuticals are not. I have read that once they find plants that are very good at helping Africans to heal, they simply send the seeds with instructions how to plant them, how you harvest them, what are the steps you go through to prepare them, and then how you take them. And then, bam, you're healed. I know that sounds like a radical thought. You're probably thinking to yourself, but Dr. Morgan, I really want to go to the hospital for the next 3 weeks. No, you don't. I know that was kind of a ridiculous comment. You do not want to go where all the sick people are, unless you want to make matters worse. Let me read this to you right here. Just consider it. Very, very interesting information. All right, let me start off here. Back during the summer of the year 2006, which I realized that was 14 years ago, we're coming up on 14 years ago, a little-known viral disease swept across a large and diverse range of islands in the Indian Ocean. On the island of Reunion, I believe that's how it's pronounced, maybe it's a French name, 265,000 people became critically ill out of a population of 770,000 individuals. So that would be what? A third, a little over a third. He goes on to write that very few of those infected were asymptomatic, meaning in nearly every case it was very severe symptoms they had. Healthcare workers on the island's hospital system were overwhelmed. This is 2006 now, not 2020. Even if they had not been, there was little they could do, so they offered what's called supportive care. In other words, they just watched what these people were going through, and they waited. Either the person's immune and the body systems would fight it off and it would bounce back and recover, or they would not. And so for many people on this island of Reunion, they didn't. They succumbed to this viral disease. The virus soon jumped to India, where an estimated 1.3 million people became ill. The culprit? A relatively little known viral disease called chikungunya fever. I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing at me trying to pronounce a type of a viral infection that I haven't practiced. The virus is known to medical science, but not well. It's not a common disease. But the problem is, it had mutated. So, as I read this to you, you're thinking coronavirus, right? Later analysis showed that the mutation had occurred sometime between the spring and the fall of 2005. And so you realize I'm talking about 2006. But the mutation had occurred somewhere between spring and fall of 2005. So within 6 months, it had become pandemic in the region. By the end of 2006, over 2 million people had become infected. Now, what does it look like? The disease is attended by severe joint pain. Talk about discouraging to a person. Somewhat like dengue fever. The ankles and the wrist are the joints that are most impacted. Ouch, that doesn't sound good to me. Conjunctivitis and a rash often occur. The pain in the joints can last for weeks or months, and it's debilitating. There's no treatment and there's no cure. The physicians recommended the use of acetaminophen for pain. Of course, you and I know acetaminophen is just another word for Tylenol. So these people are hurting. The doctors recommend acetaminophen. So what was the cause of death for many of those who died? Well, liver damage from the acetaminophen. Isn't that a kicker? People visiting the region who traveled back to their homes in the United States and Europe, well, guess what they did? They brought the disease back with them. Over 1,000 people in the U.S. were diagnosed with it. Person-to-person transmission occurred in a number of instances, infecting new hosts. Then, luckily, for most of us, the epidemic just faded away. It just disappeared. This particular disease, the chikungunya fever, is primarily spread by mosquitoes, which is not unlike a lot of viruses or infections are spread. This is the mosquito. It's called the Aedes albopictus mosquito. I'm not familiar with that one. I probably am. I've probably killed a million of them. You know, a well-placed karate chop as soon as they land on your leg. This is a mosquito that was once limited in its geographical range, but in the last 50 years, it has spread to every continent on Earth. This is an example of just how fast a new viral pathogen can spread in the global village. It began with an African virus entering the Asian mosquito that traveled by people, by plane, and by boat to the Indian Ocean in India. From there, it went everywhere. This same dynamic is now playing out every place on Earth. The chikungunya outbreak is not an uncommon event. We had the West Nile virus, or West Nile encephalitis virus, emerge in the U.S. in a large outbreak back in the year 1999. It's real. It soon spread throughout the world and is now an epidemic, endemic in Europe and Asia. In the fall of 2002, we had what's called the SARS virus, which I'm sure you know since I do not watch television. I don't pay attention to that stuff. But the SARS, that is a coronavirus. It emerged in 2002 in China and quickly spread throughout the Pan-Asia region. The epidemiologists who studied the SARS outbreak discovered that it had initially emerged in a small region in China. The physician who attended the ill then visited Hong Kong, where he promptly infected 16 people. Some of them traveled, and in doing so, they spread the disease worldwide in a matter of weeks. Then came the swine flu, and the headlines like these. Here's a headline from Jeremy Lawrence, The Independent, December 22, the year 2010. Doctors shocked by the spread of the swine flu and its severity. 460 flu victims fighting for life, as expert admits 24 deaths from swine strain, but maybe only a fraction of the true number. That comes from Sophie Borland from Mail Online, December 24, 2010. She also writes that flu crisis hits cancer surgery. Hospitals struggle to cope as deaths rise and Britain teeters on the brink of an epidemic. Only a year later, in the fall of 2011, a worldwide epidemic of dengue fever began in northern Africa. It soon spread to the Philippines and Puerto Rico. Isn't Puerto Rico getting close to home? It crossed the ocean in both directions. Finally, it hit Brazil. By April of 2012, over 50,000 people had been admitted to hospitals in Brazil. 500 newly infected people were being admitted each week. So viral diseases such as these are emerging in new and potent forms every place on Earth. There are few medical treatments for them if a reliable vaccine does not exist. And for most of them, it does not. Welcome to the 21st century. When the very first antibiotic, penicillin, came into common use back in 1946, it was heralded as the beginning of the end for infectious diseases. And as each new antibiotic was discovered, and ever more diseases conquered, the voices proclaiming the end of infectious diseases grew louder. The success of antibiotics stimulated concerted medical assaults on epidemic viral diseases, primarily through the development and the use of vaccines. You know what the first most successful vaccine was? Yeah, you're right. They had great success against the polio virus. Though it is not widely known, nearly everyone in a given region, when the polio virus spread to that area, became infected. So you may not have heard of that before, but when polio came to an area, probably the truth is every single human being had it. It was, in fact, a very common virus with very few symptoms for most people. For over 90%, they didn't have any symptoms at all, even though they were infected with it. Are you with me? Only about 8% or so had mild to moderate symptoms. Generally, a self-limited flu-like condition, which, you know, like every virus causes, like flu-like symptoms. But for about 1% of the population, the virus managed to enter the nervous system, and those people developed what most people think of as polio. It caused their limbs to shrink, or paralysis for some. And for some, a pretty bad deal. They lost their capacity to breathe on their own. And so for those, the rest of their life was lived encased in an iron lung, a shell that raised and lowered the chest mechanically. Oddly enough, given the memories that some people still have of the disease and the fear it engendered prior to the late 20th century, it was really relatively uncommon. Polio epidemics, as such, were unknown throughout most of human history. But by 1910, major epidemics of the disease had began to sweep the world. It became the scourge of the industrialized nations. The success of antibiotics after World War II, combined with the deep public fear of the disease, they drove a powerful medical movement in the search for a cure. And as with most viral diseases, the focus was on a vaccine. It didn't take long. Jonas Salk, the Salk vaccine, was discovered in 1955, and after trials in 1962, it was licensed for widespread use. I know you picked up on that, but from 1955 to 1962, that is 7 years. Just kind of hold that at the forefront of your mind, because you have to make decisions. Pretty soon, worldwide epidemics faded from memory and the infections declined from millions to the hundreds of thousands. And by the year 2007, there were a mere 1,652 cases of polio. Almost all of those were either in Asia or in Africa. So this is a powerful success story that the belief that medical science could defeat all infectious diseases spread. A 1963 comment by Australian physician Sir F. Macfarlane Burnet, a Nobel laureate, which is quite the genius, if you ask me, is very typical. By the end of the 20th century, he said, humanity would see the virtual elimination of infectious disease as a significant factor in societal life. That means we're not going to have infections in our society any longer. 7 years later, Surgeon General William Stewart testified to Congress that it was time to close the book on infectious diseases, like we don't have to deal with that stuff anymore. And for a while, it really seemed that they might be right. For the next viral disease they attacked was smallpox. Though they rarely get credit for it, it was the Russian physicians in 1958 who began to press for a worldwide program to permanently eradicate smallpox. By 1967, the program was in full swing, with some 250 million vaccinations occurring throughout the world each year. Within a decade, mostly due to the efforts of an American physician and epidemiologist, Donald Henderson, the last regions still endemic for the disease were all cleared, and the world celebrated. For the first time, a major human disease pathogen had been eradicated from the planet. Though, to be fair to the virus, both the Russians and the Americans, they always keep just a little bit of it around in their labs, just in case we might need it later. You know, only for the sake of children, of course. If you haven't ever Googled a picture of smallpox, it does not look pretty, folks. Maybe you should not do that. So the level of the triumph over smallpox was the apex of the success of the medical assault on microbial disease pathogens. Though few knew that few people knew this at the time, it was thought to be the beginning of the very end for every disease pathogen on Earth. The hubris level, already immense by 1963, grew larger. That means maybe a little bit of pride or overconfidence or arrogance there. Of course, I know I'm speaking to the choir, but you don't know anybody that's arrogant, do you? I don't. If human beings could defeat smallpox, then they could totally defeat every virus on Earth. So the word spread pretty quickly. The newspapers were filled with optimistic scenarios of a future without disease. Researchers were quoted extensively, as they still are, especially on TV probably, as saying that soon, in just a few years, none of us would ever have to die from an infectious disease. Or we'll have a vaccine for it. Just wait. And most people in the industrialized world would accept this at face value, as they still do. It is, regrettably, part of the utopian future myth of science, especially medical science, that many people take for granted. But it never has, and never has had, much to do with reality. Medical researcher and viral expert Dr. Frank Ryan makes a comment. Perhaps it is reflected in part a regrettable separation of clinicians from basic science. That's just a fancy way of saying somebody's kind of checked out of reality here. As it happens, the scientific and medical beliefs about the Earth and its interrelated life forms, including bacteria and viruses, that have been widely spread are not really that accurate. Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan, in their book, What is Life?, note that once the germ theory of contagion finally caught on, it did so with a vengeance. Different types of bacteria were implicated in anthrax and gonorrhea and typhoid, leprosy. Microbes, once little amusing anomalies, became demonized. They became a virulent other to be destroyed. But there are many problems with this belief about microbes. Two stand out for me. The first comes from that particular medical paradigm used in the West, and the second from a very inaccurate outmodeled 19th century view of nature. The medical paradigm problem is simple enough, though it's rarely recognized for the problem it is. Specifically, most physicians and medical researchers commonly speak of the cause of death when they speak of mortality. The assumption deeply embedded within that communication is that the bacteria or the virus, or I could probably say, or heart disease or stroke, caused the death. Even deeper is the communication that if all causes of death were defeated, then there would be no more death. As Harvard researcher and zoologist Richard Lewontin puts it, the claims made by medicine imply this possibility without explicitly stating it. Medical scientists speak of preventing deaths by curing disease, but the evidence is that death cannot be prevented, only postponed at best. I don't know if you believe that or not. Yes, death is postponed. We will all go the way of those that have gone before, right? Moreover, the postponement has not been as effective as it's sometimes claimed during the last 50 years of great progress in physiology and cell biology and medicine. The truth is that although the proximate cause of death can be dealt with, death itself cannot. So there must be a cause of death as a phenomenon, as distinct from the individual cases. In other words, if every cause of death were removed in spite of what physicians and the news reporters say, there would still be death. Death is inherent on the earth. The unstated and deeply buried assertion that microbes cause death is not only false, it stimulates people to view microbes as the enemies, as participants in a war against us. This is very far from the truth. Bacteria and viruses are not only a virulent other, they are instead intimately interwoven into the underpinnings of life on the planet. They cannot be killed off without killing off every life form on Earth. This is the great error of the 19th and the 20th century view of nature that continues to plague us. Or as Lynn Margulis once put it, the more balanced view of microbes as colleague and ancestor remains almost unexpressed. Our culture ignores the hard-won fact that these disease agents, these germs, this is part of life. Dealing with bacteria and their ability to cause infections like pneumonia is a bad enough problem. But when viruses enter the picture, like the coronavirus, the complexity rises by orders of a great magnitude. Viruses are not and never have been parasites, though they may act like as such or seem to be parasites when we fall sick with one. They, in fact, perform highly elegant ecosystem functions, as everything on this planet does. Maybe that's a different way of looking at this. If we go back to Genesis, and we know that God created everything that's on the planet within 6 days, and he said everything was good, right? Okay. Viruses, as Dr. Frank Ryan comments, weave in and out of the genomes of every life form on Earth. As a result, terrestrial life has become a dense web of genetic interactions. DNA, which is called deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA is not and never has been a computer program, and neither is RNA. It is, as Nobel Prize winner Barbara McClintock once noted, a living organ of the cell. DNA and RNA are both similar structures, and they are deeply interactive with the world around them. DNA is a double-stranded molecule, and RNA is a single-stranded. Both of them are intimately involved in the structural formation of life forms. DNA contains information about the genetic development of living organisms, and RNA is a messenger molecule used to carry genetic information that directs, in part, the synthesis of proteins. Proteins that are needed for the structural formation of organisms. But again, these nucleic acids are not fixed in form. They change. They adapt. We live in the midst of a constant genetic rearrangements. And these gene rearrangements occur not only in response to impulses within the organism, but also, as the Nobel Prize winning Barbara McClintock observed, to communicate from the environment around it. Specifically, viruses have this unique capacity to enter cells, snip off sections of DNA or RNA, and weave them into their own genetic structure. They can then weave those sections, as well as sections of their own genome, into other living organisms. One of their main functions, in fact, is the genetic intermingling of all life forms on Earth. Or as Frank Ryan puts it, viruses are vehicles for genetic exchange between disparate species that make up the matrix of life on Earth. In short, the perspectives of most scientists at the beginning of the antibiotic era were limited, more limited than even most knew, and the view of the world that they disseminated was deeply flawed. Viruses are deeply interwoven into the ecological matrix of this planet, and they serve functions which are essential. Maybe this is what I really want you to know today. Further, viruses are extremely adaptable. They can alter their structure very rapidly, and they can take on new forms seemingly at will. All of this is based on the virus's analysis of the environment that surrounds them. And so maybe what I'm telling you today is viruses are highly intelligent. They're not stupid. But sometimes we were stupid when we thought they were. So if we are to adapt, we have to see the virus with a different set of eyes. We have to understand it through a different paradigm. We have to realize that viruses are not what we thought them to be. We have to learn and see them as they are. Let me just kind of cut right to the chase right here. Viruses, unlike bacteria, they have no nucleus and they have no cell wall. That's a big difference. They are the minimum of life honed to structural simplicity. They're so tiny, it's just almost impossible to describe how small they are. Though there are many kinds in general, a virus is either a strand of DNA or RNA surrounded by a mathematically elegant polyhedron called a capsid, whose shape is virus specific. Maybe another way to think of it is this simplified structure makes them different from bacteria, for example, but no less alive. They are a unique life form. They are very much, and this is the analogy that I like, viruses, they are very much like seeds or spores. Now, this is what I want you to get here. They only grow when they find the right soil in which to do so. You got that? Viral seeds only grow when they find the right soil to do so. And like seeds, even though in a suspended state, they constantly monitor the exterior world around them to see if there's a good place to grow. Now, I'm trying to cut through a lot of this. I want you to understand that the polio, smallpox, those are very specific viruses that are DNA viruses. They have that double-stranded protein helix. And so a DNA virus, like a polio or smallpox, it's very, very famous for making a perfect replication of itself. But these RNA viruses, like the SARS and the corona, and the bad ones like Ebola, those are RNA viruses. They make billions of themselves, but they're not identical. It's something like a swarm of honeybees. They're all similar, but all different. They all have, just like us human beings. If you took a look at your retina compared to mine, they would be different. So I need you to think of an RNA virus like the coronavirus, like a viral swarm. The ones most similar to each other are the ones that die off when the human immune system is first activated, or a pharmaceutical drug that can recognize them is used. So the ones that all look alike, that's the easy ones to kill. This leaves the other ones that look similar, but they're not identical. They're free to multiply unchecked, and they multiply very fast. Now, this just totally shocks me, but reading the research on viruses, did you know that some viruses can produce a new generation of viruses? They can duplicate themselves every minute. So if they get into your cells and they snip off what they need to make themselves, and the whole time within this 1 minute, they can make a subtle change or they can mutate. So, for the sake of simplicity, I always keep in the back of my mind that the longer that a virus hangs around a human population, the greater the potential for it to continue to mutate. And so when you have an RNA virus like this coronavirus, it has great potential to keep changing and tweaking and adapting. And so that's one of the reasons why it is so hard and difficult to come up with a vaccine. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible, but you know as well as I do, even if you go to the doctor and say, I'd like an influenza vaccine, there is the highest probability by the time they get that to you that the virus itself, the influenza, has already slightly changed and mutated. That's what I'm talking about. And so as they gather new gene sequences from, you know, chickens and pigs and other exotic animals from Asia or China, this is one of the reasons why they have to have a new vaccine every year for the flu. See, viruses, when they're not in a living cell, they go into the state of hibernation, much like a seed from a plant would do. In this state of dormancy, they move with the air currents. So just anywhere the wind blows, there's bazillions of viruses in the air, or in the water that you're drinking. Or they simply rest dormant on the ground until they come in contact with a life form that contains cells that they need to awaken from their long, deep sleep, and they start growing again, kind of like seeds from a plant. At that moment that the virus makes contact with a human being, the virus's first task is to get inside the new host organism. It's got to bypass its protective mechanisms and find a proper host cell. Now, this is so complicated. Viruses use this highly sophisticated, elegant analysis to address these challenges. They actually begin experimenting with new combinations of genes so they can adapt to the environment they faced. Most of them have generated genetic structure that facilitates their entry into other host organisms after initial infection begins. Have you ever heard of the rabies virus? I think if it's untreated, it has basically a 99% death rate. But the rabies virus, for instance, it affects a part of the brain that then causes uncontrolled biting. So if you have a relative that's I'm joking. At the same time, the virus swarms and it's billions into the saliva of infected animals that are bitten by the one that has, you know, the rabies. Then every time the animal bites something, the virus is transmitted to a new host. Now, influenza and other respiratory viruses, they enter the respiratory droplets, you know, from a cough or a sneeze, and guess what they do? They stimulate those mechanisms in the body that stimulate coughing and sneezing. You see how this works? If it's a rabies virus, you want to bite somebody. You spread it that way. If you get influenza or upper respiratory tract infection, you start sneezing and coughing. And still other viruses spread by mosquitoes. They flood into the blood, and then they stimulate the release of chemicals through the host's skin surface that calls the mosquitoes to the infected area. That is crazy. So viruses are very, very good at getting from here to there. This is only my opinion. But if we already have tens of thousands of people that are infected with the coronavirus or testing positive, that means that viruses are very good at getting from here to there. They're very, very good. So, one of the reasons I brought this up, and I realize I'm running low on time today, I'm going to have to pick this up next week, but I want you to understand how this works. Let me see if I can find one tidbit of research here. Okay. 60 patients. This is a human study. It wasn't done on pigs or chickens, so that's good for us. 60 patients aged 18 to 54, that is not my age group, they suffered from influenza symptoms for 48 hours. Then once they had the flu for 48 hours, they were enrolled in a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled study just so they could check the effectiveness of one substance or a natural remedy. It's called elderberry syrup. Have you ever heard of elderberry? So the participants received either 15 milliliters, which is basically 1/2 ounce of an elderberry syrup, or placebo for 5 days. That's all they got. Just one dose. It says symptoms were relieved on an average of 4 days earlier in the elderberry group. Now, if you're not feeling so hot, would you rather go on for like 7 full days of feeling miserable? Or would you rather wrap that sucker up in 3 days and be done with it and be symptom-free 4 days earlier in the elderberry group? I've got to believe that's pretty impressive. Sambucol in a placebo-controlled double-blind study, this is a different one, was used to treat a group of individuals in Panama during an influenza epidemic. Those using the elderberry extract experienced a significant improvement in symptoms, including fever, in 2 days. A complete cure was recorded for most within 2 to 3 days. Serum examination showed that high hemagglutination inhibition titers to influenza, influenza B. That means it worked. Now, you got to understand, viruses are very complex. But they serve a purpose. I know it's easy to label them as the enemy, but drugs, they do not match the complexity of a plant. You know, one thing I tell myself sometimes is maybe one of the reasons that plants are so good at coming up with antiviral remedies is because they got no place to run. They either can stand their ground and fight the infection or they can't. Now, what I want to do is I want to give you some just common sense things, very, very basic. I don't know if you know this or not, but your body actually manufactures its own antibiotics. It does. One of them is called cathelcetin. And the more that I read about this, I've learned a lesson here. It is very dependent on the amount of vitamin D3 that you have in reserve at any given time. So what does this mean? This means if you have very dark skin and you're indoors all day long and your skin never comes in contact with the sunshine, then you may have a problem with vitamin D3. You may not have a rich reserve. Your gas tank may not be completely filled with vitamin D3. And so if that's the case, your ability to respond to a viral infection may be a lot worse than somebody else that may have closer to an optimal utilization and reserve of vitamin D3. So what's the solution? Well, there's two, maybe three. Number one, if the sun comes out today, even for 10 minutes, find any way you can to go out there and just soak up some rays. Help assist your body in producing vitamin D3. I know this is an oversimplification. There's probably so much more that fresh air and sunshine does to help strengthen the human body. Okay. I read that in desperation, they had 50 very severe patients. Well, I didn't tell you about how much vitamin D3 to take. I know that in the medical system, they think nothing of giving an injection of 50,000 units, sometimes 100,000, of vitamin D into a person once a week. So with that as our template, that's what's done medically in medical offices throughout the world. If you feel like that your immune system needs some bolstering or some improving, well, maybe you should take closer to, 10,000 units a day just for a very, very short season. I didn't say forever. I know as well as you do that there can be toxicity if you take too much for too long. But I can tell you right now, if you're low in vitamin D, if you took 10,000 units a day, your body's going to drink it up and put it to use. So it's just a question, do I have enough of what my body needs to counter and help my system respond to a virus appropriately? Or am I deficient? If you're deficient, well, let's start to correct that. I read about 50 patients. This was a news report. Maybe I read this a month ago, I can't remember. But they had 50 severe cases where one of the physicians said, okay, we're going to try something radical. And I did not write down the dose. I am so sorry. But they gave these 50 severely ill patients with the coronavirus, or, and, you know, the cytokine storm and all the horrific symptoms, they gave them intravenous vitamin C. And please forgive me for not knowing the exact dosage, but that probably would break down to about 3,000 milligrams orally several times a day to help bolster your immune function. See, all I want you to remember that the human immune system can continually always be able to counter a virus or an infection as long as it has vitamin C in reserve. And so there's a lot of drugs out there that completely destroy vitamin C. Maybe you're taking them. If you're a diabetic, if you're on high blood pressure medication, if you smoke cigarettes, if you're significantly overweight, if you have a junk food diet, you're probably pretty low in vitamin C. But they took these 50 patients that were in severe shape, and they gave them intravenous vitamin C. And maybe the first thing I need to tell you is they, not one of them had any side effects. Maybe they had a little diarrhea, but that wasn't mentioned in the report. It said it shortened their hospital stay by 3 to 5 days. They only did this after they were in a severe place. You tell me, is that good to exit the hospital 5 days earlier than those that did not receive the vitamin C? Oh my goodness, yes, that's a good thing. And I know this is a very small group of people, just 50, so you can take it and interpret it however you want. But all 50 of these improved. There was no mortality, no death. I just got to believe that's significant. Now, if you don't, that's your call on that. Now, the next point. I know I've made this many times, but let me make it one more time just in case somebody didn't hear. If I had to just choose one mineral for today, I'm choosing zinc. Zinc is the backbone or the cornerstone of your immune system. When you were born with this very interesting gland called the thymus gland. And as people age, the thymus gland begins to shrink. Maybe it takes a few hits. Maybe life happens and you're stressed and you get overworked and you don't get enough sleep. And maybe your thymus gland just begins to atrophy and shrink, which we know that as people age, their stomach does not digest food as well. I personally believe I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's really hard to get an adequate amount of zinc just from the food that you're eating. And if you're not eating animal products, it's probably going to be very, very hard to get enough zinc. So, I don't know if you knew this, but there's a class of drugs called ACE inhibitors. And they're used to lower blood pressure. But those are famous for depleting the body of zinc. But for the sake of conversation this morning, zinc is the backbone and the cornerstone of your immune system. You got to have it. Maybe you're getting older. Maybe you're not absorbing the nutrients from your food. Maybe you have low stomach acid. Maybe you're taking some type of a drug to block stomach acid, and that is causing a zinc deficiency. Maybe you just have a lack of zinc because you're not eating enough foods that are high in zinc, like ocean fish and such. Well, you need zinc. Zinc is one of the keys to making sure that your thymus gland, which is hands down the largest gland of your immune system, if you want your body to keep yourself in good working order, you're going to need the thymus gland that works. If your thymus gland goes down, you're going to catch everything that comes along. So you might want to consider taking zinc. One more point. I already mentioned elderberry just briefly. If you heard me talk about elderberry, you have to decide if you are compelled or convinced to even consider that. Now, I've had several days this week I did not enter the large store here in Jacksonville that sells groceries, and they have a pharmacy, and, you know, they have everything else there. You know what I'm talking about. But there is an aisle that has elderberry, and I have gone down that aisle every single day. They gone. There's none to be had. If they put some out, it's just a bottle or two, and they don't last. So I know from looking at that, because there's a shortage of elderberry supplements, that there's a lot of people out there that are really on the cutting edge of what can I do to help my body in a non-toxic way. You got to remember, pharmaceutical drugs, they are not biodegradable. When somebody goes to the bathroom and they're taking a blood pressure medication or antibiotic, guess what? That incompletely detoxified, broken down drug residue is going to go right into the water system of the city or the town that you're in. They cannot get rid of it. Some of that drug is going to go into the tap water. It's another reason not to drink tap water. Now, let me share this with you. This will be the last thing, and I'll see if I have time for a phone call. Hopefully I will. Number one, I know, because I hear this every single day, everyone is just out and out terrified of eating eggs because eggs are rich in cholesterol. Okay, I understand that narrative. I choose not to agree with that. I do not think that eggs are toxic. I think you can have a chicken in the backyard that eats earthworms and June bugs and probably ticks and flies and worms and caterpillars. From that perspective, they're probably doing the world a favor. And they give us eggs. Did you know there is a substance called an immunoglobulin? Your immune system produces it. Guess what immunoglobulins do? They bind to viruses and bacteria, resulting in your body being able to destroy them. So you're going to agree with me, right? You've got to have immunoglobulins if you're going to keep your body well. If you don't have immunoglobulins, then guess what? You can be the boy in the plastic bubble. And you can live a life in a sterile environment, because if you had someone sneeze or cough or try to bite you that had rabies, that would be all over for you because you don't produce immunoglobulins. Did you know that one egg, and if I'm not mistaken, it's specifically not the egg whites, it's the egg yolk, that contains somewhere between 100 to 150 milligrams of pure immunoglobulins. I tried to go to the bookstore yesterday. They locked up, and they is shut down until further notice. I think they said March 31st. I think it's called, what, half-price books. But they have books that I've looked at. Now, medicine's take on this is they want to give you monoclonal antibodies. Yeah, drugs. Very expensive. Lots of side effects. You know what kind of antibodies you find in eggs? They're called polyclonal. They're found in nature. I understand. There may be the rare individual, maybe more common than rare, but it's very unusual for me to come across a person that's highly allergic to eggs. So if you're not allergic to eggs, that's what I'm suggesting. If you eat eggs, one egg contains 100 to 150 milligrams of immunoglobulins, and these are the very things that help bind to viruses and bacteria, resulting in their total annihilation and destruction. Is that what you want? So eat eggs. Or check with your physician and see if that's okay with them. I'm only joking about that. If you'd like to join me on the radio, there's a phone line officially open at 903-586-5257. Let me see if I can take this call. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Yay, I got on.
you hadn't been trying very long, had you?
Yes, that was me.
Oh, that was you. Okay. Well, how can I help?
I had an ultrasound of my uterus because I just felt the heaviness, and I'm 59, and also at night I have to get up like 3 or 4 times to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, there's like a continual pressure on your bladder, right?
Yes, and so they found multiple fibroids in my uterus, and so I'm suspect because of the where it said one of them was, that it, like at the top of my uterus, that that's probably why. Yeah. Making me have that urgency to go, because I don't really go a lot, but it just, and
yeah, but you never get any relief.
I know.
The pressure is always there because of the size of the fibroid in your uterus pushing against the bladder.
Yes. And a friend of mine was telling me about her friend's daughter that miscarried because she just a couple of days ago that she had a fibroid in her uterus.
Oh, no.
That burst while she was pregnant.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry about that.
I know. It's terrible, but it made me start thinking about mine, and I hope it doesn't burst, but I'm sure there's something natural I can take to shrink those.
You know, one of the problems that we have living on this planet was we have all these man-made chemicals, and they go by a name. They're called xenoestrogens. Have you ever heard that before?
I've heard of it. Yeah, well, yeah, I think I have.
So estrogen, under normal circumstances, is a hormone that's produced by your ovaries.
Right.
Or it's synthesized by your fat cells.
Yeah, like but I have lots of those.
I'm going to just walk right around that and not make a comment. But in the world that we live in, we have all these plastics and petroleum products and chemicals that act like estrogens. And so let me give you an example. They know at Sanderson Farms, which raises a whole bunch of chickens here in East Texas, they know if they give them antibiotics, that's going to cause a female chicken to grow 225% faster than if they did not give her the antibiotics because they're full of estrogens. And estrogens cause the uterus to grow. And so if your body is bombarded by a boatload of estrogens, that's one of the problems. So I'm going to suggest to you one or two or three things are taking place. Either you've been exposed to too much estrogen, and we just might need to go through the process of detoxification.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is we got to help the body kick those out. So cruciferous vegetables are really, really hard to beat. So broccoli and kale, cauliflower, cabbage, asparagus, onions, garlic, eggs, those are all really good to help your body detoxify estrogen.
Okay.
I am such a fan of an infrared sauna.
I have one.
Oh, my word. Use it every day then. Your body requires potassium, zinc, and magnesium in order to help kick out excess estrogen. If you take organic lemon juice from a fresh-squeezed lemon or a lime and you add to your drinking water, you're helping scrub that estrogen out. When you exercise, you help improve how your body clears toxins. Plus,
so basically just a healthy way of living lifestyle.
Yes.
Anyway, okay, because I'm not going to have surgery and have those removed.
Well, if you eat meat, just make sure your chicken eggs are free-range. They're not raised with lots of chemicals. If you're going to eat beef, eat some. Just make sure it's grass-fed without hormones.
Okay.
I happen to know a husband and wife that sell grass-fed beef over in Cayuga, but I'm thinking this is pretty top-secret classified information. I could probably only give it to you if you ask.
Oh. Well,
But there's all sorts of places that. But if you did purchase grass-fed beef without the hormones and the chemicals, then you're not bombarding your body with boatloads of toxic estrogen, which is really a problem. The other thing that you have to think of is the female body is exactly 10 parts progesterone to one part estrogen. And so what if you were lacking a little bit of zinc and your body said, we just can't make as much progesterone as we used to, and your body said, we're now 9 parts progesterone to one part estrogen. Well, what that would do is that would effectively, because your progesterone levels are lowered, that would create a condition called estrogen dominance. And when you have more estrogen than what you need, it tells tissues to grow that you don't want to grow. So that's one of the problems. Your estrogen-sensitive tissues, like the uterus, they start growing abnormally large. Now, fibroids are usually benign tumors. And mm-hmm. so it's possible, if you could do enough things, for example, what if, I'm not trying to make a joke by saying this, but what if you skipped breakfast? Well, instead of you eating breakfast, your body would eat you. And that's what you want.
Well,
you want your body.
I understand.
You want your body to start eating anything that doesn't belong, and your body will start to eat the fibroids. But that's
okay.
where I think if you like to drink herbal tea, you could drink green tea and sage tea and hibiscus, and you could drink all sorts of herbal teas that have anti-estrogenic effects. Or you could start having cabbage and Brussels sprouts every day.
Okay, well, I'm writing all this down. So do I need to take a progesterone cream or something to counteract?
Today it's so easy. You could easily go to a doctor and you could say, could you just check my estrogen levels to see if I have too much? And while you're at it, could you check my progesterone and maybe testosterone. They can do all this stuff so easy. If you're a curious person and you want to know, that would answer the question very precisely for you, because hormones are pretty easy to mess up.
Well, and I did have two miscarriages, and then the third one, they realized, oh, it's because you can't maintain the pregnancy because your progesterone's too low. So they gave me progesterone.
Well, then you and I are completely on the right, on the same page here. And it may be that that's one of the issues that we have to address, is that maybe your system just doesn't produce progesterone as easily as it should, or as much as optimal. And so I know I'm just making this sound real simple. You have to have vitamin C, and you have to have zinc to make progesterone. Those are two rate-limiting elements. That means if you have less vitamin C than what you need, your body will not be able to rise to the occasion to make progesterone. I'm good at coming up with all the obscure information that nobody else talks about. It's
well,
so
I
much
do.
Easier to tell a person take progesterone. But if your body can make it, I say, hey, let's help nudge it along and make what it needs.
Okay. Well, that's what I will do. It sounds like a good prescription here, all those little things.
Good.
I'll
and just start sweating as much as you can. And would you say, can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
Would you say that you're really well hydrated? Is there room for improvement?
There's room for improvement.
Well, that's one thing that I want to ask you to do. And so if you need to change the flavor of the water, I don't have any problem with putting a splash of pomegranate juice or cranberry juice, just a little bit, to give it a little bit of a flavor. Of course, I'm personally addicted to lemons. I have them every single day in my office.
Yes, I like lemon water.
And if you could, that's one thing that definitely helps with hormone balance, is trying to hydrate. If you hydrate your body, water is the element that helps wash everything clean. I know you know that, but I just thought I'd mention it.
Okay, well, that's what I will do. I'll get right on it. I'll open my box. I had ordered a sauna, infrared sauna off Amazon, and it was only around $180.
Have you used it yet?
I had it in the box for... I'm embarrassed. I've had it in the box in my closet for about 2 years. I've never opened it.
I'm going to pretend that I didn't hear that. I am going to just so pretend that that didn't happen. But what you can do is you can take your screwdriver and pry the box open today and take it out and fold it open, set it up, turn it on. What I want you to do is turn it on for about 15 minutes before you hop inside, let it get really up to speed. And you're going to need to lay some towels, or that would be my recommendation, take a towel with you. But if you can just retrain your body to sweat profusely, that's just going to be a godsend.
Right. Well, I live in Beaumont now, but when I lived in Tyler, there was like a little salon that you could go in. I think I paid about $25 a session for an infrared sauna.
This will pay for itself now that you live in Beaumont. And plus, Beaumont is a very low humidity, very cool part of Texas.
It's not.
Oh, it's not? Okay, I got that wrong.
At least we're good for the coronavirus. They don't like humidity, and heat. So.
Oh, the coronavirus doesn't like those things?
That's what I heard.
Man, that's news to me.
I don't know.
I mean, personally, I have no problem thinking that coronavirus is going to do even better when it gets warmer.
Really?
But you never realize all these infections, they almost always start during the winter when people are indoors and vitamin D levels are low. Unfortunately, we just ran out of time. Thank you for your phone call.
Okay, sir. Thank you.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too.